Mike, can you get your crowd out of here? Thank you. Okay, the meeting of the Early Childhood and Youth Development Committee will come to order. Is there minutes?
Yep.
Representative Myra, do you want to move the minutes?
Yes.
Oh, we don't have a quorum yet. Sorry. Okay, we'll just start then with the presentation. And this is on effectiveness of early childhood education, and there's a slight change in the lineup. And it, as they're putting it together, it's brains before money. And I don't know if that refers to the person or the subject, but I think they'll they may have a in your opinion on the person. Ms. Gunner, do you want to, or it's, I guess it's Dr. Gunner, do you want to go ahead?
Thank you once again for having me back here to do what I did in 5 minutes last time, or 10 minutes, I can't remember, in 30 minutes. And so I hope what I can do is help those of you who are thinking about these things have a little better understanding of what neuroscience and developmental science tells us about brain development and why what you're considering in this committee, therefore, is terribly important. As I said before, it takes more. We're going to build a healthy brain architecture. Genes are not enough, right? Genes are critically important. They lay out the basic framework for our brain. We have human genes and not rat genes. We develop a human brain and not rat brains. And there are individual differences among us in the genes we carry. But to really develop healthy brain architecture, those genes have to operate in a supportive environment. In fact, the more we're learning about how genes function and work, the more we are seeing that actually experience writes on our genes. It creates what we call an epigenome. It regulates which genes get turned on and off. So experience is critically important for healthy brain development. There are two aspects of experience that we need to pay attention to, big classes. One is the importance of developmentally appropriate stimulation so the brain can put itself together in a healthy way, and the other is the absence to remove toxic stress and the activation of toxic stress that can have damaging effects on the developing brain. And I'm going to talk you through both sides of that equation. Genes determine the structure of the human brain, and they determine when we develop different competencies. But the way the brain puts itself together is what you're seeing here in this little slice up there is a little piece of the prefrontal cortex that's been sliced out, yes, obviously, from a child that has died. And then the actual nerves have been painstakingly copied under an electron microscope. And what you're seeing there are nerves. The long part is the axon, and you see these little connections down here. These are dendrites. And one thing that you should notice is that they're not touching one another. And the thing about nerves is they don't do anything if they don't send a signal across this nerve to the next one to coordinate an action. No surprise, the prefrontal cortex, where this is taken, deals with being able to do math and higher order reasoning and planning and things that newborns just don't do, right? So this region of the brain has not connected up. At a certain point in development, around 6 years of age, in this region of the brain, poof, you get 700 connections a second being formed. And that's under genetic control. And then nature's slick trick here is you don't want all those 700 connections a second being there because they're communicating a lot of noise. The signals, the pathways that get used get confirmed, and the ones that aren't being used peel away so that by the time this region of the brain is done developing, you actually have fewer connections, but they're sending information that is actually producing outcomes that are effective. So the brain is basically organizing itself by what it's thinking about. In a sense, that's the way to think about that. Now, this doesn't happen at the same time across all regions of the brain. Regions in the back of the brain that are involved in vision and hearing have that period of overproliferation and pruning earlier. Whoops, over-pruned myself. Regions a little bit further up here in this region that are involved in language and thoughts like that have their period of overproliferation and pruning a little later. And then we get to those regions in the prefrontal cortex that I was showing you before where you have that overproliferation and pruning into the adolescent years of life. And, I mean, it follows what we know about babies, right? They come, they're born, they don't see terribly well, but that vision improves very quickly, their hearing improves quickly, they begin to coordinate hearing and touching and all those senses, then we begin to get language forming and so on. The critical point here is, though, once that pruning is over, it's not that you can't learn those things ever again, but the ease with which we learn them diminishes. And as the brain organizes itself, it begins to use these neural pathways for one thing, and it becomes harder for them to use it for something else. And we know that from examples like when somebody has a lazy eye, you know what that is? One eye just doesn't focus very or hold itself very clearly. And our treatment for that is to cover up the good eye for periods of time during the day to force that lazy eye to be sending information. If we don't do that, the brain gets all organized around this good eye. And then when you fix this eye, it still doesn't matter. There's no place for the information to go. So the brain organizes itself by what it's thinking about over these periods of time when it's developing. And once you organize yourself one way, it's tough to go back and restructure another way. And this proliferation and pruning is a very rapid way of learning. So the thing to point out here is that so much of this is happening during the early years of life. And we like to think of this as it's like you're setting up the basic foundations for a house. You want to set up a good, solid foundation. So all of this beautiful higher order reasoning we do with our prefrontal cortex, which is gorgeous, it's what we do so much of the time as adults, we can build that out on top of this strong foundation. If you get disturbances in the early part of development, your prefrontal cortex is trying to organize itself with somewhat faulty input. So it's really nice to get it solidly set up in the beginning. I hope I've convinced you that neurodevelopment requires stimulation. The brain becomes what the brain does. The interesting thing, and you really have to ask what Mother Nature was up to, is that human infants are born among the most helpless of mammals, and that left on our own as a baby, we cannot supply ourselves with the stimulation we need to put together normal brain architecture. Well, that works because we are born into and our brains develop in the context of relationships. And in the context of those relationships, you have an incredible rich amount of stimulation. I like to say that, you know, a baby on its own can't do anything except a baby can run an entire household. With a responsive set of adults around, it runs entire households. So the stimulation that the baby is getting from adults, grandparent in this case, who is providing plenty of interesting stimulation for that baby's brain to develop while she is rotting that child's poor teeth, probably, provides the kinds of stimulation that the brain needs. And the interesting thing about babies and young children is information that's just a little bit beyond what they understand, they find captivating. Once they understand it completely, it becomes what? Boring! And the reason that social relationships are wonderful context for development is when the child becomes bored, we change our behavior. We do something more interesting. So the child, in a way, is able, in a responsive environment, to help guide the information that's just beyond what he or she understands. We think of this as a process of serve and return. Psychologists call it interaction, but it really is like playing a game of ball. The child organizes an action. That means the brain has organized an action, sent signals down through those nerves. And when it gets a response that is appropriate and positive, those nerve cells get, that pathway gets confirmed. And through that process of serve and return, we're developing that healthy brain architecture. It works better with people that the child knows, because the child knows what to do and the adult knows how to adjust. Just like playing a game of ball with a child, if you've never met them and they're three and you're trying to play catch, the ball could go anywhere, but if you know the child, you can adjust and you get longer strings of action going. from everything I've said, you should not be surprised to hear that everything we know is that the achievement gap begins to emerge early. This is a study that you'll see also in Rob Grunewald's presentation. It was done a long time ago. But every study we have that's come since this has actually validated it and actually pushed the timing earlier. Here they were keeping track of the number of words that a child knew. And no surprise, the number of words that children say up to about 16 months doesn't really differentiate by the kind of education that their parents have had and therefore the kind of language-rich environment that the child is in. But if you're asking what word can the child say, by 24 months you begin to see that differentiation emerging. By the way, we can predict from 24 months to third grade reading scores. By 36 months, it's there. That doesn't mean it's written in stone, but skills beget skills. So what you learn early gives you a leg up for the next thing you learn, and so on. We can push this back way earlier if we use sneaky techniques to understand what the baby knows. So if you show the child two pictures, a ball and a truck, ball and doll or something, doesn't matter what it is, except they should be words in the child's vocabulary, and you have them stare at a little fixation point, and then something in front of them begins to say ball. Well, if you're watching and it's a ball versus a truck, and you know these words, as the thing starts to say bah, your eyes start to move. So if you track eye movements, early on, babies need to hear ball, and then their eyes move. But as they learn the language, even long before they ever say it, the eyes move. And you begin to get pictures like this emerging as early as 9-10 months of age, because children learn words long before they ever speak them. So you can push it back younger. But what I've told you is the architecture of the brain is shaped by experiences. Skills beget skills. Simple skills build later developing skills. Brain architecture develops in the context of relationships. Of course, the child also learns about the physical world, but relationships are critically important because we're richer sources of information. Serve and return provides those experiences that literally allow the brain to build itself. And a poor early foundation then affects what's coming afterwards. Not that we can't fix things later, but it's harder. The achievement gaps begin early in life. What I've been talking about are the growth-promoting stimulation. I'm going to turn over here and talk about adversity and toxic stress. We want the growth-promoting stuff. We need to make sure that the brain is not exposed to toxic levels of stress. These are the regions of the brain that are involved in memory and learning. The hippocampus, which is that little green thing that looks like a green bean, and no, it doesn't look that way inside your head. It's not colored. The little red thing that is the amygdala that's critically important for tagging information, for its emotional salience, and then that area that is the prefrontal cortex. We need these regions. That green bean thing helps us put information into long-term memory. The red thing tags it as important, which is why if you are married, you probably vividly remember your marriage, your wedding day, the birth of your first child, these important salient things. And the prefrontal cortex that helps us organize information. These are the regions of the brain that are involved in fear and anxiety, and they're the same regions. But they do different things, and the way our brain has evolved is when we are anxious and fearful, we take the reasoning part of our brain offline so that we can react immediately. I like to tell the story of my husband, physicist, who was at home grading a dissertation when the tornado came through that hit Apache Plaza, which was right near where we were living. He's watching the trees. He's a stupid Texan. He's watching the trees sway and everything like that. And he says the next thing he remembers, he and the cats were fighting for the corner in the basement. And he literally does not remember anything in between. Something happened. It triggered the fear system. It took away his reasoning system and sent him to the basement as fast as possible. This is the way our brains have evolved. If we have learned to expect threat at lower thresholds, then what we are going to do is take the reasoning part of our brain offline very rapidly. This is part of what some kids are struggling with in school, is they've grown up in an environment where threat is possible. It's hard to keep that offline while you end up spending your time thinking about when Columbus sailed the bright blue sea. There are three levels of stress that are critically important for shaping the brain in terms of fear and anxiety versus reasoning. Positive level, we produce increases in heart rate, mild levels of stress hormones, we learn to deal with it, we discover that we're competent and capable. That's good stress. Tolerable stress is we're producing higher levels of these stress chemicals, but in the context of supportive relationships, we can bring that down and we may well learn to handle difficult situations. So the stuff that we're all concerned about is this toxic level where we produce high levels of stress hormones and neurochemistry. It keeps up there very high for a long time, and it literally can alter and damage the way the brain develops. If this is an animal study, we have many of them that look like this. What you're actually looking at in the top panel is a pyramidal cell, a type of nerve cell, sitting in either the hippocampus or the prefrontal cortex. And you can see that it's got the little center to it, it's got all these connections, all these processes. If you look at the bottom, that's the way that cell will look if you dump in stress hormones on it for a while, or if you take that poor animal and you stick it in a terrifying context repeatedly. And what you should notice is you've got all these nice connections, and they're not there. They've retracted is actually what happens. And if we look at the actual dendrite, see the little knobby things there? Those are actually synapses, the connections between where there would be connections between nerves. And what's actually happened is you've lost connections. So chronic stress actually causes the brain to get to retract in these two areas. If this was your amygdala, that emotion center, it would get bigger. Do you want me to stop? You're acting like you want me to stop?
No. I'm trying to figure out whether to allow questions. We're trying to figure out if we want to get everything in. And so
I'm close to the end. Do you want to let me finish the next?
Okay, why don't we do that?
Okay. So we know if we look at kids, we see evidence that those who are under chronic neglect or abuse do have altered activity of these stress hormone systems. We know from my own work, if we follow kids up years later after pulling them out of these difficult contexts and look at a part of the brain that's very sensitive to stress chemicals, that these are our controls. They have a much larger hippocampus. Kids that we pull out 4 to 12 months of age, smaller. And if they're in those contexts for even longer, we see even smaller hippocampus. So I'm at the end. How do we act, guys? You get it right the first time, obviously, because it takes more energy and more money to fix it later. But you know, we can do that if we need to, and the more we understand, the more we can do. And it points to three levels of services, the science work that we have on intervention. Basic services that make sure all kids have basically good health, common community learning opportunities, targeted supports for kids that support major risk factors, and then highly specialized interventions for kids that are facing a lot more. And that is all I came to say to you all.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you. Is it Gunner?
Yes.
Dr. Gunner. Returning to your slide, toxic stress changes brain architecture. You mm-hmm. talked about the stress hormones essentially yep. Having this effect on damaging connections. I'm curious about, you mentioned the neurochemistry involved. Is it literally higher production of these types of stress hormones, and are they literally coursing through the blood, through the brain, and it's having this impact? What period of time does it begin to have an effect? How does that interaction actually work?
Dr. Gunner.
Sure. Mr. Mallory and the committee. The timeline seems to be that very brief exposures, so an hour or two, you see changes, you see immediate changes, but then it reverts back. So it's not only what's the production of the chemicals and their impact, but also how much time in between. So you get the effect, and then it comes back. If it's chronic, if it's repeated day after day after day, or produced for very long periods of time, if you have Cushing syndrome, and you push it up, I mean, biologically, you end up with these high levels for chronic periods, then we see these kinds of effects. The trick with kids, and there's so much, almost anything we ask, we know a lot more about grown-up animals and grown-up people than we do about little kids. The trick with what we know about kids is the process may actually look somewhat different, and there may actually be more sustained and long-term effects with a rapidly developing organism. But we still, there's a lot we don't know. The question is, how long can I get a kid really stressed and produce without seeing effects? Wouldn't want to do it for terribly long, and it may differ by kids because your genetics, the genes you carry, may also interact with what your capacity is to tolerate these longer periods of stress. Does that help you?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Garner, just one follow-up. The beginning of your presentation, you showed the roughly up to 6 years of age, the connections forming, and then there's
mm-hmm. That's the prefrontal cortex. Yes.
Prefrontal cortex, as an mm-hmm. example. Is there a pattern to the types of damage that occurs based on these sustained stress hormones? Is it certain parts of the brain that are more susceptible to it than others? Is it depend on what stage you are at in terms of your pruning process when the stress occurs?
Dr. Gunner?
Yes. Yes, and yes. From what we understand, and most of this, of course, comes, to be very clear, it comes from animal research where we can do this level of work. The timing does matter. The effects on earlier developing regions of the brain can be a little bit different than the later developing regions. But both, interestingly, both the hippocampus, which develops a bit earlier, and the prefrontal cortex have similar, roughly similar patterns of disconnection under conditions of really severe and chronic stress. The difference is that that amygdala, the emotion center, may actually actually become enhanced and better at processing information, which of course the effect would be to more easily take reasoning offline and have you react quickly. It's not like nature necessarily hates us, right? These are probably adaptive changes that have promoted survival, but not necessarily the capacity to work well in school or function in an information technology environment.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gunner, just briefly, could you tell us what we know about the brain's capacity for healing or regeneration?
Yeah. So every time you tell, every time you tell this story, it sounds like we might as well only work with kids that have done really well and had a safe early environment. One of the remarkable things about people is we are an incredibly adaptive organism, and we can do workarounds for a lot of things. So when I showed you the children with the reduced size of the hippocampus, it is affecting their memory ability, but many of these children are doing reasonably well in high school, they were or grade school, but they're learning. You know, they write down things more, right? You just can't remember it, so you write it down. We learn ways of adapting and getting around some of our difficulties. But it's harder, and it's much better. I mean, if we're going to think on a public health standpoint, it'd be much better to have a society with a bunch of kids where we don't have to do that more extensive workaround. The more we understand about how the brain works, the more we can figure out how to get in there. But fixing some of these problems often takes intensive work.
I think I have some questions, but could you stay around?
Sure.
In case.
Happy.
We have a really.
I know, you got a busy day, and we got to get Rob.
And now we want, apparently, your references. He's the money, and you're the brain.
The money. Here it comes. Show me the money. There you go.
Oh. Representative Hall, would you move the minutes while we're break?
Sure, Chair. I'll move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Hall. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Is this a team approach then?
Told me to stay here.
Mr. Grunwald, I think you're first.
Sure.
Just go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm honored to be here and to present to you. I am an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. That's why I represent the money. But before I get to the money, I've been asked to review some of our research on the impact of early childhood education programs. And I'm going to move through that research. First, just a motivation for our discussion. As economists look at this issue in terms of the impact on our labor force, is that if we reach children early, based on the research that was presented here by Dr. Gunner, the children are more likely to succeed in school, enter our workforce, succeed, less likely to commit crime. These are some of the impact of these early childhood education programs. And as we look forward in terms of the demographics for Minnesota's labor force, is that the growth in the labor force is expected to slow over the next few decades relative to how it has been growing in the past. And why this motivates economists is that we need every child to show up at kindergarten prepared to succeed and successfully move through that school period and be successful in life. So this graph here just shows that Dr. Gunner and I are on the same page. I'm just going to skip ahead. There's four large or long-term studies that have been conducted. I'm going to start with long-term studies and then go to more recent studies. And what these long-term studies do is look at the impact of a high-quality early childhood education intervention with high-risk children early in their life. The most widely cited of these studies is the Perry Preschool Program, which children back in the 1960s were randomly assigned to participate in the preschool program, where they received a half-day preschool experience with a well-trained teacher. The researchers were able to track both the graduates of the Perry program and the control group up to the age of 40. And as they moved through that research, they found that kids performed better in school, their achievement scores were higher, their graduation rates were higher, 65% graduation rate compared with 45%. Of course, we want that 65% to be higher, but the difference between these two groups is going to bear out in higher education levels for the Perry graduates and also higher earnings once they reach the workforce. Also, they were less likely to require special education. At the age of 40, there were a number of differences between the Perry graduates and the control group. Home ownership rates were higher, higher earnings in the workforce. And coming from the Federal Reserve, I was interested that they also were more likely to have a savings account at a bank. Most of the public savings to this particular program came from reductions in crime. All crime rates from felonies down to misdemeanors were essentially cut in half. And this, on average, resulted in a year and a half reduction in incarceration time. That's a review of the Perry Preschool Program. I'm going to briefly discuss the other three studies. The Abecedarian Educational Child Care Program is a full-day experience for children just a few months of age until reaching kindergarten. And in this study, that also used a randomized trial, they showed that children who were in this program were less likely to repeat a grade. At the age of 21, they were less likely to be smoking, using that as a proxy for healthy living habits. And the children who attended this program were three times more likely to attend college as an adult. Now, different from these smaller scale pilots in which just over 100 children were participating, the study of the Chicago Child Parent Center project is a large scale project. Here, Arthur Reynolds is the lead researcher on this project. He's here at the University of Minnesota. What they did is looked at graduates of the Chicago Child Parent Center program, where they received a half-day preschool program at ages 3 and 4, that also included parent education activities at the center. They tracked these children through their schooling relative to a group of children who did not attend these centers. They found that special education rates were reduced, high school completion rates were increased, juvenile and also adult arrests were reduced as well. And finally, different from a center-based or place-based program, a home visiting program, which is the start of what is now known as the Nurse Family Partnership project, was originally studied in Elmira, New York. And here, a registered nurse visits an at-risk expectant mother who has a risk quality, such as being young and single and low income, and stays with that mother, that family, until the child reaches the age of 2. And researchers here found that the home environment was safer, there were fewer emergency room visits, at the age of 15, child arrest rates were reduced, and months on welfare were reduced. So all four of these studies use a high-quality research design. They have long-term follow-up. And what it allows economists to do is to step in and to conduct the cost-benefit analysis. You know, for example, for the Prairie Preschool Program, economists first add up the cost of the program, which in today's dollars is about $11,000 per year per child. On average, the children attended for just over a year and a half. And then you start add up the savings from that project, such as reductions in special education placements. We see the savings in the K through 12 area. Higher participant earnings, so most of that's a private benefit, but some comes back to the public in the form of higher tax revenue. Reduced need of the criminal justice system, that is reduced need for police protection, court costs, and incarceration costs, and also reductions to the victims of crime. So when you add up all of these benefits relative to costs, it's a high ratio of benefits to costs, $16 return for every dollar invested. What Art Rolnick, who's a recently retired director of research at the Minneapolis Fed, and I did with these numbers, is we calculated an annual rate of return. What is that annual interest rate over the lifetime of these benefits? We estimate that the annual return at 18%, most of the benefit is accruing to the public, to the non-participants. We estimate that public return at 16%. Nobel laureate James Heckman, an economist at the University of Chicago, has reviewed all of this data and makes a couple different assumptions, and he finds a return of 10%. These are all adjusted for inflation and return better than the stock market over a long time horizon, which on average has returned about 6% when you adjust for inflation. The same cost-benefit analyses were conducted with the other three projects. All of these benefits, as you see here, are over one. That means you're getting your money back. And when we translate to annual interest rates, or the internal rate of return, they range from 7% up to 20%. And when we ask who benefits the most from these interventions, well, certainly the children, their parents, their families benefit. Most of the benefit accrues to the non-participants, or to the public. About 60 to 65% of the benefits accrue to the non-participants. Now, all of this evidence is based on long-term research studies that were started many years ago. But more recent research on state-funded pre-K programs have been able to establish that they have a positive impact on children if they attend for a year at the age of four. The researchers have been using a technique called regression discontinuity design, and I'll explain more if you want to ask me a question about that. But what basically that technique does is that you're able to establish that the program itself is the cause of the impact that you see in the gains in the scores. The five states that are represented here represent five different types of preschool programs. For example, Oklahoma is a universal program. West Virginia is also aiming towards a universal acquisition or availability for all kids. Michigan, for example, is targeted to children who are at risk. And when they look at these benefits across vocabulary, math skills, print awareness skills, they see that they are finding what they call in social science large effect sizes. That is, they're getting up into that large and medium range of effects. Now, I'm going to anticipate also a question. I didn't build a similar slide for Head Start's randomized trial. But I want to use this as a way to describe those effect sizes. Over 10 years ago when that study was conducted, after spending a year or two in Head Start, they found positive effect sizes. They were more in that small to medium range, and so they're establishing a program impact. Of course, what many of you are familiar with is that those gains were not found between the first and third grade. And so we want to step back and talk a little bit about the context of those findings. Steve Barnett, who's a researcher at Rutgers University, notes that as you continue to track the scores of the kids coming from Head Starts and those who did not participate in Head Start, is that both groups are continuing to see gains in their scores during their early elementary years, but those kids that didn't go to Head Start were certainly catching up. And that's why you're not seeing those differences. Head Start has also been working hard to improve their quality, moving that program towards a school readiness program. I know that Minnesota, our Head Start Association here, has that as a primary goal to continue to improve the quality so that Head Start is to having a positive impact on kids as they come to school. Furthermore, there's some long-term, non-experimental research that shows and suggest is that there's impact later on in life, in later grades in school and also in early adulthood, that are showing up from attending Head Start. That is, that some of the benefits from attending Head Start, such as the social, emotional, and executive functioning development of the child, are helping to show that kids are doing better later on in their schooling and also showing some impact in later adulthood. I'm going to conclude with just one more mention of a study from Michigan. They've had a longer-term follow-up with their kids. It's not a randomized trial, so that there could be some problems of some selection bias here. But recently released, they show that particularly for children of color who went to their four-year-old preschool program, the graduation rates, or on-time graduation rates from high school were significantly larger than children that did not attend. They also found that there was a notable reduction in grade retention. I know that that state is based on this study and other research on their program, is interested in expanding that program going forward. Finally, just some themes from the research across all of these programs in terms of how to invest so we make sure that we're achieving a high rate of return. First of it's investing in quality, making sure we have well-trained teachers, relatively low ratios of children to teachers, using a research-backed curriculum, involving parents as children's primary teachers, first teachers, starting early so that our continuum of investments, starting early, prenatal and birth, all the way to kindergarten, reaching the at-risk population will achieve the highest rate of return, because here we're going to be able to use prevention dollars effectively as opposed to remedial dollars later on that are less effective and more expensive, and also to bring to scale. Just looking at the year coming forward, in terms of children at 185% of poverty and below, that this state is reaching less than a third of them with a high-quality early childhood program and before going on into kindergarten. Thank you. Resources, as you can see on your handout.
Thank you. Mr. Chase, are you...
Thank you, Chair Mullery and committee.
Pardon?
You want me to talk now?
Yes, right. Go ahead.
Thank you. And
state your name.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Richard Chase, a senior research manager at Wilder Research for the Wilder Foundation, and you should be getting a handout. $56,000. That's the economic value if we get just one more child who would not otherwise be ready for school when they start kindergarten, ready for school. We have the opportunity to reap that amount because school readiness is linked to school success, future employment, higher income, higher taxes paid, or we could needlessly spend or lose that amount because conversely, a child that starts school at a disadvantage is more likely to drop out, need special help, eventually earn lower wages, depend on public assistance, abuse alcohol, drugs, and end up in prison. In short, as Professor Gunner said, skills beget skills. Success begets success, but also disadvantage begets disadvantage. So the probabilities vary based on the investment in school readiness for low-income kids. So $56,000 is the present value of probable savings and returns over the lifetime of that child, discounted at 4%. It's based upon the actual spending in Minnesota in the actual rates of high school graduation, special ed use, and spending on special education, MFIP, substance abuse treatment, and so on. And then it takes the research that Rob talked about, the reputable research from Washington State Policy Institute, from HiSCOPE, from Arthur Reynolds, and it looks at what is the impact of an effective programs on the spending in those various categories. So it uses those effect sizes that Rob talked about, the impact, and it reduces the spending in each of those categories based upon that effect size of the program. So I can give you details of that if you'd like, but I'd rather, and you probably wouldn't like me to go into the weeds right now on that, so I won't, but if you want me to, I can do that. But the handout you have shows the breakdown of where the $56,000 accrues. How much accrues to which part of the state? So look at special education saves a little under $2,000 per child. The savings with regard to incarceration, with regard to use of welfare and time on welfare. There's additional taxes paid because of the higher income. There's less use of and lower time on unemployment insurance. And then there's that crime victim cost that saved, big savings in treatment costs for substance abuse. And then there's the individual then also reaps about 15% of the benefit by earning higher wages. So in the long run, as Rob and Megan have said, it's a lot cheaper to invest in preventing the achievement gap than to live with the ramifications and consequences of it and to try to close it once it occurs. So right now, because we have at least 15,000 low-income kids who lack access to effective early learning opportunities, the dice are loaded to waste and lose money on those kids. But, and given that the youngest children in the state are the poorest part of the population and the most diverse population, if we don't invest in those children at an early age and get them ready for school, if we don't, in other words, load the dice in favor of savings and reaping the revenue from those children and the success that begets success, the wastes and costs will continue to grow $56,000 at a time. So we have the opportunity to benefit by investing in those young kids, or we have the opportunity to continue to waste state money and lose money and not gain the revenue from those children. The choice is ours, but the opportunity is there to achieve this dividend. And all you have to do is multiply it, 56,000, by how many children you want to invest in, and that will be the amount the state receives. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll take a couple questions now if there's any of either Mr. Grunwald or Mr. Chase. Oh. What? Oh, Representative Breinert will go first.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grunwald, I wanted to ask you, is it Mr. Grunwald or Dr. Grunwald? I don't know what your title is, but all right, okay. I just wanted to honor whatever your academic achievement level might be. Yes, obviously, a high achiever, yes. I won't ask you to explain the regression analysis, but I wanted to ask you about the comments you made regarding the Head Start 10-year data. They are not a part of the record you gave us of your remarks, and I'd really like to have that analysis if we could. I think it would be a benefit to the committee as a whole if it's available.
Mr. Grunwald, can you? I think probably everybody would echo that. Can you supply that information?
Mr. Chair, certainly. I'll pass that along.
Thank you. Representative Breinert is. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, this also is to Mr. Grunwald, and I think maybe to Dr. Gunner as well. Dr. Gunner's presentation on brain development, it seemed to me, aligns most closely with the socio-emotional and executive function component of the Head Start studies that you talked about. And it seemed to me that you're talking about slightly different things, I guess, in that part of your presentation. Just wonder if you could comment on economic impact on academic or cognitive ability versus the socio-emotional and executive function type development. It seems to me just instinctively that the academic stuff is not quite as important. But
let's see. Did you ask Mr. Grunwald?
Yeah.
Mr. Grunwald.
Mr. Chair, both are important. Professor James Heckman has looked at this very closely, because when we talk about fade-out, fade-out was first pointed at the Perry Preschool Study. After 10 years, what they noted is that the children that attended Perry had higher IQ scores than the control group. But by about the fourth grade, there was no difference in the IQ score. So at that point, researchers were thinking, well, maybe the Perry Preschool isn't worth investing in. But they continued to notice that children were achieving higher grades. They were more likely to graduate from high school. That is, their motivation, their persistence, these social, emotional, slash executive functioning skills were motivating that performance. So what James Heckman has talked about is the cognitive skills we measure in terms of emerging literacy and mathematics, problem solving, and also those non-cognitive skills that you're referring to, the social, emotional. Later in life, what we might talk about in employment is the soft skills, that is, being able to work well in groups and be able to take on a task and motivated to perform well. So both domains are important, but economists and researchers are agreeing that indeed, when we look at this body of research, that there's a strong impact on the non-cognitive skills. We need to attend those in development.
And I'm
Dr. Gunner.
Dr. Gunner's going wild on this, but I have a kind of a question on what's the cognitive skills? Is that the executive skills or the IQ skills that you're talking about when you say cognitive skills? Or is this Dr. Gunner going to answer that too?
I'm going to answer that if that's okay.
Okay,
so, Dr. Representative Mullery, when we think about cognition, we often divide cognitive functioning into crystallized skills, crystallized cognition, and fluid cognition. Crystallized and fluid. So if you remember your multiplication tables, that's a knowledge base, that's crystallized intelligence, or your vocabulary. How you solve problems, how you approach a problem, how you think about it, what you can keep in working memory, whether you can change flexibly if one path doesn't work and the other is needed, that's fluid intelligence. That's executive function. And both of these are intelligence and cognitive. We frequently in school test crystallized intelligence. We test, did you learn your multiplication tables? Have you memorized those? We don't as often test fluid intelligence, but both are needed to function, and for reasons that I think we really don't yet understand. These programs early on, they support both crystallized intelligence and fluid intelligence, but as we test them once the kids get to school, the other kids are catching up on memorizing and being able to respond to the tests. But there's something about that early experience that has been critically important in setting the child up for developing better fluid intelligence capabilities. And it's fluid intelligence that allows you to be smart enough not to do something dumb like rob a bank. Or if you do, not to get caught. So these aspects that we aren't assessing, they are not soft. They're intelligence. And I think we've mislabeled them, so that's why I was having this conniption fit. It's hard stuff that we really can test. It's intelligence. It's just not the type that we typically test on IQ tests, which are and on achievement tests in school. So I'm sorry. It's important to keep in mind, this really is not soft stuff. It's really hard stuff, too. It's just not what we typically assess.
So in other words, we're not testing the right thing. Okay. Representative Winkler, did you have
a Mr. Chair and Mr. Grunwald, I guess what I was trying to understand is whether the Head Start fade-out effect and the other kinds of ROI-type work that you do distinguishes between these two kinds of intelligence.
Mr. Grunwald, I think.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm just going to lean on Professor Gunner's work here and her comments that it is that in terms of the difference is that it's easier to test a crystallized, to use the term for the first time, I'm using it, intelligence versus a fluid intelligence, that is the social emotional side, those measures are still nascent. It's harder to be able to track that movement. I think using my previous language in terms of what Dr. Heckman is looking at, is that he became convinced, looking at the Perry Preschool, that indeed that which we don't test in that crystallized intelligence, what Heckman refers to as those cognitive skills, indeed is not capturing all the impact that it's having on kids. And certainly in the Perry Project, we are seeing the impact of this fluid intelligence is helping these kids succeed, not only through school, but well into adulthood.
I have just a couple quick ones. Dr. Gunner, when you showed on your slide on page 3 at the top, the higher cognitive function,
that last curve?
Peaks around 3, you kind of show it disappearing.
Oh, okay.
Or going down around 8, and I was wondering, when you're saying higher cognitive function, we often, and maybe we're wrong totally, but we often talk about the IQ function and the executive functions. And I know the executive functions, there's a lot of research showing that the brain grows the most on those from age 8 to 18.
Right.
And continues till maybe 21, 24. Mm-hmm.
So how does
that relate to this thing? Is this the IQ or the other? Or
what that graph is showing is when you get that under genetic control, that rapid 700 second setting up of connections. And then the brain's job, the learning job, is to work the brain, use that, create the patterns that work, and prune back the connection. So what you're seeing there is the number of synapses, and the synapses decrease over time as you're laying down pathways that you're using. So pruning is actually a part of getting better. So the pruning is the growth that's happening as those patterns are getting laid down, and you're opening up different regions of the brain to have that pruning and patterning and connections happening at different points in development. The prefrontal regions of the brain, you sort of poof, and at about age 6, you've got the most connections, and then it takes many, many years to really prune those and get that fully formed. And then once you've got them pruned, you get the little myelin sheath going so that you get the white matter there and send the connections faster. And yes, it's not complete until about age 25, and then it's downhill from there.
Yeah. So, in other words, most of us are
then
downhill.
Then we gain wisdom.
I've got some more questions, but I better go to. And can you stay around because we need to? And in fact, I think today we really have to get out because I've heard that there's zoo animals coming in here, and we don't want to have those of us that are legislators confused with them or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Banovitz, I've just been informed that the Minnesota animals were canceled for this room, and maybe that they were worried about confusion with us. But Mr. Banovitz, could
Correct.
You go ahead?
Yes. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Nicholas Banovitz. I'm the deputy director at MNCAN. We are a statewide centrist education advocacy nonprofit. We have nearly 5,500 members in our network, but today I'm also here as a representative of the relatively new campaign called Mini Minds. Some of you I know have heard of it, but for those of you who haven't, we are about 50 organizations strong, encompassing all geographies and demographics and industries and whatnot in the state, working to increase access for children who are at or below 185% of poverty, to give them greater access to high-quality early education opportunities in Minnesota. In 2011, MNCAN, along with many other organizations, helped expand parent aware.
Mr. Banovitz, can I just clarify something?
Yes.
You said MNCAN is the one working with the children under 885% of poverty, or all of Many Minds?
So Many Minds. Many Minds is a campaign. Okay. There are about 50 organizations in Minnesota that are part, that have signed on to the coalition. Okay. And Many Minds is working towards increasing access for three and four, or for all children in Minnesota who are living at or below 185% poverty to high quality early education and care programs in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. In 2011, MNCAN, along with many other organizations, helped expand with the Minnesota Legislature and Governor Dayton, expand Parent Aware to be a statewide platform. Parent Aware, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is an online platform that helps connect parents and families to high-quality early learning opportunities in the state of Minnesota. It will be fully statewide in 2015. We also worked on supporting Minnesota's successful Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant application, in which Minnesota received nearly $45 million for. And I mention these two projects because it's really, it indicates and reinforces that we have the infrastructure in place in Minnesota to connect families and children to high-quality early education programs. Many Minds is working on the next step, and that's to make sure that we increase access to those programs. At the work at MNCAN, we advocate for meaningful education reform policies, policies that will help close the achievement gaps in our public schools, which are among the worst in the United States. We work to get more kids college and career ready. As you may know, by the year 2018, 70% of all Minnesota jobs will require some level of post-secondary education. We also work to improve high school graduation rates in Minnesota, which for students of color are among the worst in the country. Our work is inclusive of funding opportunities, new revenue or not, that is aligned with quality and accountability. You've heard today that 50% or nearly 50% of Minnesota children enter kindergarten not fully prepared to learn. And the long-term effects can be near insurmountable for our children. Everything from remedial education to special ed, graduation rates, college enrollment, and even prison. And the cost burden that our state bears to support children who are not entering kindergarten fully ready to learn is approximately $850 million each year. Many Minds helps address this. It is a great opportunity to provide more of our children access to high-quality early learning opportunities and to make sure that they succeed in the K-12 system. So in an effort to help bring all of the wisdom and the smarts that are behind me with the researchers in Minnesota and help bring that to the general public, MNCAN worked in cooperation with the Many Minds campaign to create the infographic that's in front of you. And just want to share or draw attention to a few of the statistics that are in the infographic. This hasn't been released quite yet. Starting next week and through the next several months, this will be sent out and distributed to newspapers across the state, to community organizations, elected officials, and whatnot. The research that you see on the infographic, it comes from the abundance of local research that we have here in Minnesota, and it's really grounded also with the research, but also in the piloted Parent Aware program that took place in Minnesota. The Many Minds asked $185 million for the next biennium, costs approximately one-fifth of the current price tag that Minnesota's paying, that $850 million. That's in everything from increased K-12 costs, crime, prison, reduced income and tax base, and the list goes on. But we also know that kids who do enter kindergarten fully prepared to learn are far more likely to stay in school, graduate from high school, enroll in college, and stay out of prison. The $850 million price tag is the equivalent of hiring an additional 21,500 teachers for Minnesota schools, or buying every Minnesota student a new iPad, and still having $540 million left over. So from MNCAN's perspective and the 5,500 Minnesotans that we represent, and on behalf of the Many Minds campaign, we simply cannot afford not to do this. I welcome any questions, and again, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little off topic because I'm very broadly supportive of the investment. I've been supportive and involved in early childhood for 20 to 30 years, but I have to ask, is Many Minds willing to step up and help us address the revenue issues that would allow us to make this investment?
Sure. And I'll answer that to the best of my ability.
Benefits.
Mr. Chair, can I proceed?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But
sorry.
And you have to wait till I call on you,
sorry.
Because the record on the
okay.
tape.
My apologies. There are many coalition partners who are rising to the opportunity and supporting the revenue increase to help support Many Minds, MinCAN being one of those. We issued a public statement about a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago following the release of the governor's proposed budget, supporting the revenue increase, especially since this is aligned with quality and accountability.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is your Nicholas?
Yes.
Okay. So, Nicholas, you're saying that Many Minds supports the governor's budget proposal? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Benevitz?
What I'm saying is that MinCAN supports it.
Okay. May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. So you realize that the budget that the governor has done hurts middle-class Minnesotans and the working poor the most. So you're saying you support that in order to fund a new program?
Well, Mr. Banovitz, you may want to be careful on the assumption in that question, but go ahead and answer.
Sure. What I will say is that MinCAN supports the $44 million that Governor Dayton has included in his proposed budget to help expand and increase access to high-quality early learning education for Minnesota students.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I guess you're not really truly answering the question because that budget does expand, although it does lower the sales tax, it does expand into a lot of areas now that are not currently taxed that would be taxed underneath the governor's proposal. For example, Tylenol would be taxed, medication that children use, clothing would be taxed, children do need new jackets, so business-to-business sales tax would be absorbed, and people that go buy these services, they would be taxed on the high end too. So I'd just be very careful that you aren't, stretching these people more than they already are.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, the next testifier will...
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Winkler.
I guess I'd just like to say for the record that I thought Mr. Banovitz said that he supported the governor's proposal for early education funding, not that he supported the governor's entire budget proposal.
I think that was clear by his answer. You clarified and made it clearer what he had already said. Representative Franzen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify for the record, too, that the funding for the early childhood programming would come also from working poor and middle-class Minnesotans.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you. This is not the Tax Committee. Barb Yates.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Yates. I'm Executive Director of Think Small, and I have the privilege of chairing the Governor's Early Learning Council.
Thank you. We're getting confused on titles, and people are asking, is there some title we're supposed to use for you? Or
Barb's fine.
Okay. Go ahead.
The Minnesota Early Learning Council is responsible for advising the governor, the children's cabinet, and the legislature on priorities for supporting our youngest learners. We are in existence as a result of a federal law through the Head Start program that asked states to set up early care and education councils. The council has been in existence since I think the first council was under Governor Pawlenty. There's also state statute that gives us some duties, and the governor has an executive order for the council. The council's made up of 22 people from across Minnesota that are appointed by the governor. There are four people from state agencies, and there are four legislators that are appointed by the majority and minority in each body that sit on the council as well. Two of my council members, Diane Halsey and Carol Miller, are in the audience today, and Karen Cadigan, Dr. Cadigan, represents the Department of Education Office of Early Learning on the council as well. We're pleased by the governor's leadership on early childhood care and education and the importance he's placed on early learning in his 7-point education plan. In the short time since the council first came together, we've made great strides by creating a strategic plan to guide our work. We've supported the successful grant application that brought nearly $45 million in federal funds to Minnesota through the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant. The council continues to provide feedback and advice to the Office of Early Learning over implementation of this effort. We are guided by our strategic plan and six listening sessions that we held around the state of Minnesota. The council's organized its work through committees around the following five topics. We have one group, it's a rural and special populations committee. Then this group considers the impact of Race to the Top activities and other Early Learning Council recommendations on rural areas and on special populations, providing a voice for these concerns. The second area of focus is access, and this group is currently focusing on increasing the availability of resources to provide access to high-quality early childhood programs. Our first work focused on access for 3- and 4-year-olds, and the committee is now turning its attention to looking at services and programs that provide for children birth through age 3. Another committee is the accountability group, which will find out where Minnesota is in meeting the needs of our young children and will let the people of Minnesota know about it. We have a workforce committee that is also working on developing recommendations regarding statewide professional development and career advancement plans for early childhood educators. And finally, we have a pre-K to grade 3 group that's making recommendations to work toward meeting the goal that children will read by third grade. Now, guided by the work of the Access Committee, the Council voted to support an increased access for high-quality early care and education programs for children from low-income families as our top legislative priority for this session. We made that recommendation to the Governor's Office and to the Children's Cabinet. The Council has recommended to Governor Dayton and the Children's Cabinet that substantial flexible funds be included in the Governor's budget to accomplish this. And these funds will help low-income families receive early care and education programming for their children that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford or access a high-quality program. Every child deserves the opportunity to start school healthy and ready to learn. However, in Minnesota, too many children start behind and don't catch up. The achievement gap in Minnesota is shameful. Fortunately, both local and national research shows that investing in access to high-quality early childhood programs and services can do much to close the gap and yield an extraordinary return. We look forward to continuing work with you, with the governor, and with the Children's Cabinet in addressing these issues.
Thank you. Could you repeat again the one sentence that said what the priority was?
Our priority is increased access for children from low-income families, for 3- and 4-year-olds, to high-quality programming.
Are there any questions? Ms. Yates? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Annie Pearson?
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grathwell with Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm joined by Annie Pearson. I'm just teeing her up, and I'm her technical assistant, if you can imagine that. Annie Pearson is a lead teacher, master teacher in our High Five program, and we're just going to run through a couple slides about our High Five, not to do with pensions. It's a 4-year-old kindergarten program. We call it High Five in Minneapolis.
Mr. Grathwell, you're always looking for a place to appear.
That's true.
But could you, when you talk a little bit slower?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for letting me come today. It's really exciting to be here and to be hearing all of the things. We've known for a long time how important early childhood education is and what a difference it can make in kids' lives. I'm lucky enough to be in the classroom looking at those four-year-olds every day. And I'm also lucky enough to be looking and talking with families who have three-year-olds who want those opportunities for their kids. So the work you're doing is really important, not just for the future of the economy, but for the future of real live kids who have great smiles and personalities and are learning things every day. What we brought was probably way too much, but what we want to talk about is a little bit of the work that we're doing in Minneapolis at closing what we're calling the opportunity gap, which is what happens before we have an achievement gap. And if we do our work well, we won't have an achievement gap, and that would be a happy thing. If you're looking at some of the slide that's up right now, just what we're trying to do in Minneapolis is increase the number of kids that are in high-quality programs. We work with community partners to provide support for them also. We're trying to increase the effectiveness of our preschool programs. We know from the Perry Project and the Chicago Project, all of those, we know the key components. We also know what our kids need to be successful as they enter kindergarten, so we're fine-tuning that. We're using data to do that regularly. We're aligning what happens in pre-K with what happens in kindergarten. We're working at improving the transition for all kids as they come in so that families who are engaged and involved with their preschool kids are also involved and engaged as their kids come into elementary school. And then we're really focusing on increasing participation of families that are learning, English language learning families, families that are living below that poverty line, families who have other circumstances that are increasing the likelihood that their children might not be ready for kindergarten. We're working with homeless and highly mobile families. And we've really fine-tuned our efforts to make our demographics in High Five reflect the needs of our city. So we're working with the kids that we know need these experiences. Screening has really changed where they screen, how they screen, who they invite, partners that they work with. And because of that, our screening data now really reflects who is three in Minneapolis. So we're getting really close to that. ECFE has increased participation of African American families, Native American families, ELL. They're doing some real careful programming with partners to get the families that most need to hear our message. And we're also working with our High Five families because we've already got the kids, so now we're trying to connect with their families and help them. If you look at the next thing, you're looking at the race, ethnicity of kids screened, and you can see the changes that we've made as they reflect the demographics of our city. If you look at ECFE, changes we've made in who is coming to ECFE classes, and that's reflected in the families that are eligible for free or reduced lunch. If you look at the race, ethnicity of kids in ECFE, you can see we're making some changes as we're changing the way we're programming. And then here's my comfort zone. This is where my heart is. It's with this four-year-old program. We call it High Five, but it's for those kids who are going to be in kindergarten next year. We also have one session of an amazing program we call preschool for kids who are going to be in kindergarten in 2 years. It's an amazing opportunity for kids to really gain some of the skills, both the low-hanging fruit, those crystallized skills, but also the fluid skills that we're aiming for, the high fruit, the top apples at the tree, the high fruit, the top apples at the tree that are going to make a difference in their lives. Okay, when you're looking at the percentage of kindergarten students meeting or exceeding the benchmark, we're proud of the work that we're doing. We're proud of the changes and the disparity between high-performing students and students that came in with more things working against them or with families that had more stresses. If you're looking at the amount that the gap has changed, it's showing that we're accessing the kids that most need our program. Overall, the scores have gone up. We were at 72% last year of our kids that looked ready according to their entering data on the kindergarten benchmark test. If you look at this is called out by ethnicity, or no, by home language. So if you look at the kids that spoke English that were ready, the kids that spoke Hmong, the kids that spoke Somali, or the kids who spoke Spanish at their home as their home language. And we're using this data to kind of drive what we do and how we change it. We have been concerned about our Spanish speaker scores, so this past week we've been planning and trying to figure out what we're going to do to address it. We're going to pilot a couple of programs that's going to support kids' growth in their home language, because we know that that's one way to increase their overall language and school readiness skills. And so we're going to pilot a program that's going to provide that support to them in a bilingual classroom or in a Spanish immersion kind of classroom. When you look at the assessments, we assess in the big five of literacy. We take 11 known predictors of reading success. And because 11 are hard to remember, we kind of boil them down to five, kind of combine things. And this lets you know kind of what we're doing with our kids when it comes to the phonemic awareness. Are they able to hear the sounds of language? Alphabetic principle, do they understand about what letters do, what they mean, the sounds they make, the names of them? This is the one that we're really focusing a lot on, is language, because we know that's at the heart of all of their future learning, is do they have enough background knowledge, enough information, enough vocabulary, enough language skills to be able to successfully navigate the school and the world. And so then we come up with a total literacy score. We also have there our total numeracy score, where we're looking at the things that are predictors of mathematical success. When you look at the scores of who was meeting the goals by home language, that's this next slide. As you're seeing some of the things, it's not always a perfect science, like going up and going down. But we also have, we've looked at some of the reasons that some of those went down a little bit. We got better at recruiting the kids who most need us. We're working with screening. When you look at the numbers of kids that are screened, as kids come through screening, if they aren't indicated that they need special ed services, but there are concerns, we are loading our high five classrooms with those kids and giving them the experiences that they need. As we've gotten better at our outreach, we're accessing more kids who didn't have the ability to take advantage of some of these programs. And so it means that sometimes scores go down a little bit as we change who's coming. We're getting more families who might not know to reach out to us by how we're weighting who comes in and what we do. So I think what we wanted to just talk about is that we're making really steady progress in reducing those racial disparities. We're fine-tuning our program. We're working on the quality. We're working on access, who gets there, where we have kids. Jim was asking me a question about what happens when we have these kids coming into kindergarten. And two things happen. One of them is that the kids who don't get a high-quality experience look more discrepant. Kids who would have been part of the majority now look further behind because other kids have had those opportunities. The sad thing about that is that we could change that by having more spots, more places, more access for them. The partially good thing about that is kindergarten teachers say, I now have time to work with those kids because I have a core group of kids who are coming in with the skills that they need. And so under an RTI model, a response to intervention model, teachers are able to focus more time and energy. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we had all of our kids coming in with the skills that they needed? We're using data to drive the improvement efforts. We're looking at who we're underserving. We're looking at how kids are doing. We're looking at what is really making a difference. Minneapolis has made investments in early childhood education. They're using their title money to support us. Yes. We're really trying to carefully integrate with early childhood education, and we're aligning with the K-12 system so that we're all heading towards the same things. The goals that we have for our pre-kinders line up with the goals that people have for their kindergarten students. One of the really exciting things we're doing is working with parent engagement and education. Our ELL department is doing some things with helping immigrant families. It's being targeted especially for immigrant families, but helping them learn what they can do to support their kids. We have them culturally specific for different ethnic groups. And we're really trying to expand how we connect our high five families, because we have the kids, with the parenting education of ECFE classrooms. So we're knowing we have to adapt and change. So we're excited about what we're doing. We're really excited about what you have the ability to do. just make this happen for more kids. And do you have any questions?
I do, but I'll see what else Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Pearson, one of the things that struck me in a couple of your slides was how well the Somali kids are doing. And I wonder if you have any explanation for that. I mean, not to say, I mean, we sort of hear this typically on racial or English language differences, the achievement in school. So the Somalis would seem to be an outlier in that comparison. So I wonder if you could just shed some
Ms.
light
Pearson?
On that.
We look at that, too, in wonderment and in sort of awe. And we have come up with some things. We've done some research, but I can tell you what we are surmising. One is that Somali families have, at least in Minneapolis, really made a concerted effort to engage in the education process. When we do our early childhood enrollment, Somali families, through a sense of community and networking within the community, get the word out. They know as a group when the due date is for getting those cards in. They know the process that they go through, and they support other people in the community on doing that. So we have a fair number of Somali students enrolled in our programs. I think they also have made themselves available to some of the things of knowing, some of the things that we know are important. Somali families, even if they didn't speak a lot of English, were very confident about teaching about letters and letter sounds. They knew that was important to their kids, and they did a good job of doing that. I think we have spread the word about reading with your kids and talking with your kids and the importance of language and vocabulary. And it was exciting for me to see that on our beginning kindergarten. That score went way up in the Somali community. In the past years, the letters, the alphabetic principal scores were very high, and the language scores weren't as high, which isn't surprising. This year, they went up. 1 year does not make a trend, but it is still exciting to see that in the community, word is spreading that there are other things you do to support your kids in their readiness for school. So I think that might be part of it. I think what we have to do is figure out how we help other groups form those same kind of networks and get the information to them in ways so that they can help their kids, because every family I've ever worked with wants the very best for their kids, and we just have to get better at figuring out how we help them know what some of those things are.
Representative Winkler, did you have another question? I then, your chart on page, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of times in your presentation, you talked about alignment and transitions, and I'm wondering if the lessons you're learning, if you've yet created any conversation across systems with that focus on alignment and transitions. In other words, other preschool programs, are you yet trying to have that conversation about aligning with K-12 and kindergarten itself?
Ms. Pearson.
Absolutely. That's one of the favorite parts of my work, is working with PICA, Head Start. We meet regularly with them monthly to talk about the transitions, to talk about the goals, about what's happening in kindergartens. We've provided PD for their staff about what our literacy concerns are, how the reading works, because they have a strong network of advocates that work closely with families. We work with Way to Grow. They have advocates to go out to the home, and we provide training to them on a monthly basis about the literacy and the numeracy things that are happening for kids in kindergarten and beyond through third grade, and then I sort of run out of understanding. But we get them going well through third grade. We work with neighborhood daycares and partner with Turnquist's Child Care Center, Northside Child Development, people serving people at the homeless shelter, trying to get this message to as many families as we can.
I was starting on page 4. You have race, ethnicity of children, and I was trying to figure out, I missed what you said that was. Is that the number of participating from, for instance, whites or Hispanics or Asian? The number or the percentage of children in that category that are participating? Or is it the...
Is this the slide about screening? Mr. Chairman?
The one on the left.
Okay.
Sorry, I couldn't.
What that is showing is the race, ethnicity of the children that were screened between 2010 and 2012.
That does not look like the picture that were this one.
Oh, I'm looking at this one.
It says race, ethnicity of children, ECFE 2010 to 2012.
Yep, this one.
Oh, it's page 4, slide 7, he said.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I think now we're looking at the same slide.
Yes, that helps. Yes.
So this is showing the children and the families that were enrolled in ECFE classes in Minneapolis. The race or the ethnicity of the children is stated by their families. And the question...
The question is what are these percentages of? Is
okay.
It the percentages of
in
of children
in
that are white or that are participating?
In 2010, 56% of the children that participated in ECFE in Minneapolis were white.
Oh.
In 2012, that had dropped to 33%. As the other groups went up. In 2010, 10% of our participants were African-American families. We've, through outreach and through partnering with agencies, increased that now to 36% of our families.
Okay. At one point several years ago, and hopefully it's changed, but and I won't name who because they may still be working for the system, a person running an ECFE center was having a lot of problems not getting African-American or Hmong children in.
Right.
And that person hired recruiters from those two communities, and suddenly the parents who would not participate were coming in and saying the program was wonderful, and then 807 told them that they weren't supposed to have those recruiters, and so they had to drop them, and the participation left. Is that policy still going on, that you can't have people that are recruiters going out into the communities of color, or has that been ended?
I sure hope it's not true, because we're doing it.
Okay, good.
So don't tell anybody. Just hope we're not going to go over that.
Mr. Chair, this isn't being recorded, is it?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I tend to be very honest about these things, and so we're doing what we need to do. We have figured out ways of connecting with communities of faith. We have figured out ways of connecting with medical agencies that serve different agencies or different ethnic groups or have connections. We have hired, maybe we call them AEs instead of recruiters, associate educators, but people that will go and meet with these groups first on their comfort zones at the places where they are congregating and do some things there, and then as their comfort has grown, invite them to come to the school situation.
Good. Representative Lane has a question of Dr. Gunner, as do I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Dr. Gunner, you have said again that you can predict third grade reading by 24 months, and that we always say that you can predict adult success by third grade reading, so we tend to focus a lot on third grade reading, and by doing so we emphasize skill, we emphasize what I would call the crystallized learning. But what is actually this a marker of? We use it as a marker, but it's basically saying that 24 months you predict the adult success. So what are we actually marking when we say third grade reading?
Dr. Gunner.
Yes, Representative Mullery and Lane. By predicting, I didn't say we predicted perfectly. Right. Okay. So we're better than chance at predicting third grade reading. Of course, we'd be much better off predicting vocabulary at age 3 from 24-month vocabulary. And vocabulary at age 3 would predict vocabulary at age 4. As you go a little further out, the predictions drop off, but they're still significant up to grade 3 if you've got a really good measure of the child's vocabulary at 24 months, at least in several studies where that's been done.
So can we predict adult? Well, that's pretty far out. We're probably lost our prediction by that point. So we're following developmental pathways.
Right.
This sets up the skill that begets that skill, begets that skill, begets that skill. Over time, our prediction goes down. But as early as age two, we're able to account for some of that variation, significant statistically, by grade three. It says that you're on the pathway, and that if you can get the skills up early on, then you're on a different pathway potentially.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just suggesting that we're really marking the more of the fluid cognitive skills than we are the crystallized, because adult success isn't necessarily based on remembering your math tables or how to pronounce them. but there's something more that's going on that these are markers of.
Dr. Gunner.
There's a lot of things going on. But you know, your adult success, if you're a physicist, really does depend on your ability to understand that with the skills that we're developing are promoting skills. And I don't want to downplay crystallized intelligence. Good Lord, IQ really does have, that's what we're talking about, as big predictors. It is a lot, IQ is a lot about what we've learned and we're able to retain and able to do. So while we're beginning to get a better understanding of more of this fluid side, it being pushed that direction in these talks by the fact that, gee, you know, the achievement gains begin to wane, and yet we're still seeing that these kids are more likely to graduate from high school and hold a job and not be in jail. So something was happening we weren't assessing. And it is probably on the side of more fluid intelligence reasoning, and probably also that the kids early on in an environment where teachers are supportive and are learning to love teachers. They're learning to feel safe and comfortable in an academic environment. They're learning to belong to academia, to learning. And that's a piece of that puzzle that's critical. We've learned that children who are securely attached to their parents are more likely, when things get rough, to be able to use the support of other adults who come into their lives, because they have a different set of expectations than kids who have not maybe had those experiences. So that may be part of that soft side. But it's all important. I will take every IQ point I can get. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Representative Byron.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Gunner.
Yes.
So it is possible for children to gain that fluid intelligence from their parents. And so what's really a real concern is when parents are not being effective, and that for those children at risk, that they would have that fluid education being provided in that early childhood.
Dr. Gunner, sorry, I almost defamed you by calling you a legislator.
Right. So, Representative Mullery, and one of the things that we are getting very interested in taking a look at is executive function skills are really important for good parenting. Mm-hmm. Being able to keep things in memory, being able to regulate our emotions, not having our hot emotions come and rob us of reasoning skills. Research, we're beginning to take a look at how the executive functions of the parent allow them to create that environment that then will allow the child to grow in both their knowledge of how the world works and their knowledge of how to work the world, which is really what we're sort of talking about here. And then how to, as the more we learn about how this part of the brain is working, the more we're developing this is other people, but a lot at the Institute of Child Development, developing techniques to begin to go in and help develop those skills and brain training, train the brain to be able to improve those. And there's a lot of interest in whether we may be doing some of that, not just telling parents, gee, you need to do all these great things for your kid, but actually helping them develop some of those cognitive skills that are necessary to be able to do that while dealing with issues of depression and so on, might be really important in helping really give families the opportunity to do what they can. as we heard in that last presentation, though, there are a lot of cultural groups where they are banding together and providing some of that support and infrastructure for the families. I mean, that's great. No.
Good follow. Oh, I have a question. The KIPP Institute, and I understood a study, there was a lot of claims that they were very successful with intensive kind of all around the student, and they were moving the IQ scores up. Then there was a follow-up study that showed that they were those same youth, when they got out of the institute, were not successful, even actually were below, somewhere around, they certainly were not above, but I was hearing they were below other students, and there was speculation, at least, that it was because they hadn't learned, I guess you would call it the fluid or the executive function part of the brain to follow through on their own. Is that exhibited in other cases, or are there other studies that show that?
Representative Mueller, I don't know the studies about KIPP, so I don't want to make a comment.
I
don't know that particular set of studies. But one of the things that we do know is that memorization is really important. We should not toss the concept of memorizing out of school. But if you learn everything by rote, you haven't had an opportunity to exercise discretion, and you're great at memorizing, but you can't solve problems. So good education has both memorizing stuff, so you don't have to look it up. Even though we all have iPads now, it really is helpful not to have to look everything up. But also learning how to use information to solve problems that where the solution isn't obvious, and we have to think creatively and so on. We tend to argue that one of the reasons that Americans are really good at what we do is that we don't maybe do as much memorizing as some places in other parts of the world, but we do a lot of creative problem solving. Now, we can little OD on the creative problem solving side of things, but, you know, we have a bit of both. And so you need both. But the brain needs to both solve problems and learn stuff.
Well, thanks. If it looks like there's no further questions, do you want to make a pitch for your institute or?
What, the Institute of Child Development?
Since you don't make any money off it, I'll let you make a pitch.
I'd make a.
Oh, no, the program coming up that relates to this.
Oh, that pitch. I'll be more than happy to pitch that. On Thursday, though, you can't come because we've oversubscribed. You can come, your schedule, or you can send another friend. We're doing a program at the Institute of Child Development talking about what we know, presenting more information about the role of experience and the way it may be influencing the achievement gap, and there are 8 of us professors who are speaking, and if you come, we're sitting you around the table with there are 15 of us total, so you'll have a little individualized seminar with a professor talking about these things as well, and that's Thursday morning. And we'll probably, if we don't blow it this time, this is our first time trying this, we'll do it again.
Okay, good. Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.